Good morning. I'd like to bring this meeting of House Education to order. It's about 8:06, and today we have present with us Representative Keller, Representative Munoz, Representative Wilson, Representative Gardner, Representative Book, and Chair Seaton. Representative Edgman is excused today, and today we are going to hear a presentation on the State of Alaska funding formula, and it's presented by Eddie Jeans. And before we get started, Eddie, do you want to go through your PowerPoint presentation first and then have us come back to questions, or do you want us to stop you if we have questions as you go?
For the record, Eddie Jeans, Director of School Finance for the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. Mr. Chairman, I'd like committee members to ask questions as we go through the PowerPoint presentation. So we'll address them as we're at that particular issue.
That's very good.
He's asking for it.
And before we get started, is there any other questions or any committee business that people have? Okay, seeing none, we did get the coffee cups in the room, so there are coffee cups back there now. Eddie, proceed, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And little housekeeping here. I did distribute the foundation overview again. I know you all have it, but I wasn't sure if you would bring them with you today. The reason it's important to have it is the PowerPoint actually ties in with this, and you'll see it when we get into the PowerPoint presentation. It makes references to the two spreadsheets at the back of this document, so it actually gives you points you to the right area of that spreadsheet for the calculations. Mr. Chairman, I did want to spend a couple minutes going over giving the committee a little background in the public schools setting and how we're established here in the state of Alaska. We do have 53 school districts in the state of Alaska. 19 of them are what we call regional education attendance areas. And then we have 34 city and borough school districts, which are either first-class cities or organized boroughs. And then we do have one state-operated school in the state, which is Mount Edgecombe, which is located in Sitka.
Representative Wilson.
I just missed that because I was writing down something. I'm sorry. How many boroughs?
34.
34, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we have approximately 130,000 students that we're serving through the public school system in the state of Alaska right now. Another thing that's kind of interesting is the makeup of the public schools in the state. The regional education attendance areas typically will serve multiple communities within a certain region. So we look out at number 32 here on our map, I believe is the Lower Kuskokwim School District, or I'm sorry, Lower Yukon School District. And in Lower Yukon, Mr. Chairman, they're serving 11 communities in that district. The district itself is about 19,000 square miles. They're serving approximately 2,000 students in those 11 communities. So you look at an area like that, and then you go to a place, let's say, for instance, Cake here in Southeast Island. It's a first-class city. Has one school, actually encompasses 1 mile, and they're serving 95 students. In Anchorage, we're serving 55,000 students in the Anchorage Bowl, and well, not just the Bowl, but up to Girdwood as well. So you can see we have a wide range in the sizes of school districts in the state of Alaska. And in the makeup of them, whether they're incorporated or not incorporated, the unorganized areas don't have authority to raise taxes to support public schools. And most of their support outside of state support is going to come from the Impact Aid Program, and we'll talk about that in a little bit.
And Eddie, we had a question from Representative Boot.
I wanted to go back to your very first statement and have you reiterate that just for emphasis. How big was the district? How many students?
That was the Lower Yukon School District. the district itself covers 19,000 square miles. It serves 11 communities, and it serves approximately 2,000 students.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And to carry that out a little bit further, within those 11 communities, the population ranges, student population anyway, from 42 at the low, the smallest community, up to almost 400 students in their largest community.
And so, Eddie, do you have a chart of all the different school districts that have that information on?
Mr. Chairman, I do, and I don't want to give it to you today because I need to do some updating to it.
That's fine, but if you would provide it to the committee later,
it's a really neat chart because I mean, if you look at it and you look at how many communities are being served, the range of the communities in terms of student population, it's really quite an eye-opener. Before you go on,
do all of the REAAs, the rural education attendance areas, do they all serve multiple schools, or are some of them single site?
Mr. Chairman, there's one single site, and that would be the Kashanmute School District, which serves Chivac.
Where's that on?
It's over in here somewhere in this area. The next smallest would be the Upiat School District, which serves three communities. Both of those school districts were created by the legislature around 1985, and they were the last of the BIA schools being transferred over to the state of Alaska for operation.
Very good. Just a minute. Committee members, is it helpful to have the lights off, or do you want the lights on to be able to write?
This is fine.
Okay. Great.
Mr. Chairman, there is another schedule that I want to don't have with me today that I do want to share with the committee, and it has the number of schools that we serve within a certain range of students. So, for example, I believe, so we're going to have to make sure that this is true when I get the schedule for you, but I believe we have approximately 50 schools in this state that serve less than 100 students. Okay, we only have 500 schools in the state of Alaska. So those would be schools in communities that have 50 or fewer students.
So Eddie, the chart that you're going to provide on that, is it going to just show the schools and their population throughout?
No, Mr. Chairman, the chart that I'm going to provide you, I think we have it broken down into five categories, you know, fewer than 50, 50 to 75, and it just has a raw number count, how many schools in the state are serving within that range.
Okay, and can you also, is it also available for those under 15 or those that are, so that we have an idea of how many are jumping back and forth across the 10 line or have that potential, if that's available?
Mr. Chairman, we can provide you with that information. Typically, when the schools go below 10, it's pretty rare for them to come back up above 10. But we can provide you with that information. And we do have a list of schools that have closed since 1999 that I'd be happy to provide.
Yeah, we're looking at the rural perspective and the rural impacts with energy and all that. So I think that would be helpful to the committee to know how many are in that, you know, under 15 range anyway, and those other closure.
Yeah, we can do that.
It would be helpful. We have two questions, or three questions. Representative Keller, then Representative Wilson, then Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Eddie, could you, does the chart show student-teacher ratios per community? Is that easy to come up with and include in the, what I'd be interested in in particular is your smaller schools, you know, under 50, what the student-teacher ratio is, but the whole spectrum would be nice to know if it's easily incorporated.
We do have that information. If we don't currently create that report, it's when we can.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. I'm just thinking about when I came in my district, Pelican City Schools. I remember they had 35 kids when I first went there, and that was 8 years ago, and they now have 13. So I would imagine that pretty soon they're going to be dropping past that point of no return. So.
Were you asking?
No, just no. Just a comment.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Chairman. Eddie,
yes.
If a school drops below 10, what is the process for allowing that school to regain population, or are they immediately subject to a closure process?
Well, through the chair, Representative Munoz, the state doesn't actually close the school. It's the local school board that makes that determination. And actually, last year, under House Bill 273, there's a hold harmless provision in there that provides transition funding for districts, not individual schools, but for districts. But quite often in these districts that have small schools that fall below 10, that will be enough to trigger them to qualify for the hold harmless. So I think what you might see here in the next couple years, as we have some schools fall below 10, that the district will actually keep it open for a year to see if they can get that population back up. Right now, up until now, basically when they fall below 10, they lose over $200,000 in the state funding formula. They still get funding, but they're funded with the next smallest community in the district. And quite frankly, it just isn't enough revenue to operate a school. So the boards have made that hard decision to go ahead and close the school. But I think with this hold harmless, the transition funding, you're going to see some communities keeping a school open for one additional year to see if they can get back up to the 10. If not, they will probably close it the following year.
Follow up, Representative Munoz.
Does the hold harmless funding then include the $200,000 site funding, or is that?
Actually, we're going to get to the hold harmless in the presentation, so if we could hold that till then, that would be great.
Eddie, I just had one other question. At some point, we're going to want to talk about, you know, why we're schools of 10 or above, why that cutoff line is there, why well, there is schools.
Mr. Chairman, I could answer that right now. When the funding formula was rewritten in 1998, the legislature established that policy call to set a minimum level of 10. The reason for that was local school boards would not close a school even when they got down to two or three kids. And we actually had some schools operating in the state with two or three children. And so the legislature set the policy when the funding formula was rewritten that you weren't going to be completely cut off from state aid, but it was going to be pretty tough to continue to operate those small schools. And in fact, at the time that minimum level was established, the legislature was talking about a number as high as 25. So 10 was a pretty good deal for some communities.
Thanks, Eddie. Okay. Don't see any more questions. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, we'll go ahead and get started with the presentation. First slide's pretty explanatory. If you have any questions later on, please send me an email or call me. The current funding formula was established under Senate Bill 36 in 1998. It was implemented in 1999, and the statute is AS 1417. And you can find all the lovely legal terminology used right there in that statute. This presentation will provide an overview of the calculations of the adjusted average daily membership. This is a student population. Calculations of basic need, which is what I call entitlement. That's after we've gone through all the adjustments, which we'll get to in more detail. Components of basic need. We talked about this the other day. Who pays for it? Additional funds above basic need, and then, of course, the components of state aid. Mr. Chairman, the average daily membership is the number of students enrolled during the 20-day count period in October. It's not based on attendance. Many people think it's based, you know, on attendance. If the kids are there 20 days, great, you get to count them. No, it's based on enrollment. We have children that are hunting or traveling or whatever during that 20 days, and as long as they're still enrolled, they're counted for state funding. The reports are due to the department within 2 weeks after the end of the 20-day count period. If I didn't mention it, the count period ends the fourth Friday in October. Sometimes that spills back into September. Sometimes it doesn't. And then the districts also have to provide us with a projected student count by November 5th. Typically, they're submitting both of these reports at the same time. So they're doing their actual count. They get a good feel for where they are in the current year. Typically, they use that as their estimate as well, or pretty close. And the projected student count is what we use at the department to build our budget that comes before you for consideration. Who qualifies as a student? Well,
so Eddie, let me back up. Yep. So the projected student count is a projected student count for that current year, or is that projected for the following year, since we'll be working on
Mr. Chairman, it's budget. For the upcoming school year. We have the actual count for the current year that happens in October, last October for the current year. Based on that count, we will calculate what the district's funding will be for the current school year. For their first 9 months of the school year, they receive 1/12 of their total entitlement from last year. The last 3 months, we adjust it based on this year's count. So they will be funded based on the October count, but they also provide us with a projection for next year, which is what we use to build our budget that's before the legislature for 2010.
Thank you. Representative Keller has a question.
Is the term enrollment, the students enrolled, that has been in place for a long time? Because I was definitely confused at that point. I thought there was days that were significant in the schools for the student count. And I was told that, at least, and I never researched it. But is enrollment something new? When you base the ADM on enrollment, or is that a statute playing with it?
The enrollment has always been the way we calculate average daily membership. There's another term that's called average daily attendance. Okay. And there are two different calculations. One is based on attendance, is the child physically there? The other one is enrollment. Are they enrolled in the public school system?
Follow up, Representative Keller.
So the ADM is what is used in the formula. What is the ADA used for?
In the state of Alaska, we don't use ADA for anything other than reporting purposes to the public in the report card. I'm thinking that it's also used in the food service program, but that's the federal program, and I'd have to double check that for you. In some states, they do use average daily attendance as their method of calculating state aid, but we've used average daily membership in Alaska as long as I can remember.
Thank you.
Students that are entitled to state funding, that's a child who is 6 before September 1st and under the age of 20 and has not completed the 12th grade. In Alaska, completing the 12th grade has two requirements to it. First, you have to have the credit requirement of 21 credits, plus you have to pass the high school qualifying exam. Then you're considered a graduate in the state of Alaska. So if we have a student that has met all their credit requirements but has not passed all three parts of the high school qualifying exam, and say they're 18, then they're welcome to come back into the public schools, get whatever additional resources that they need to help them pass that qualifying exam, and they're still funded through the foundation program. Now, districts would be required to count them on a part-time basis because they would not be full-time students. But if they're coming in and getting remedial classes in, say, mathematics, they're probably going to count as a quarter-time student, and they can continue that until they're 20 years old.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. One of the things that concerns me about students starting at the university is the high percentage of kids who need remedial work in really basic classes, even when they're high school graduates and recent high school graduates. I'm not talking about people who come back 10 years later. Right. And their math skills are rusty. Would you have an opinion about a proposal to have somebody who has met the high school graduation requirements, has all the course numbers, and has passed the qualifying exam, and goes immediately to UAA and has to take remedial math in order to begin normal freshman classes. I find it troubling that they're paying university tuition for that, where I think they should have recourse to the local school to get the skills that are lacking when they have a diploma. How would that impact this, or what would you think of it?
Well, through the chair, Representative Gardner, Commissioner Ledoux is interested in the concept of, I think he calls them middle colleges, or, and I think that after a student passes a high school qualifying exam, that at that point they may be able to start those courses that would help them at the college level be more productive students. The high school qualifying exam in the state of Alaska is a minimal competency exam. It is not saying that the child is ready to attend college. It says that they have minimal skills to move on and graduate from high school. So if the public believes that the high school qualifying exam should measure a student's ability to move on to college level coursework, then we have the wrong exam in place.
Follow up, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I understand that, but I guess what I'm trying to get at is a person who's passed the qualifying exam and met the degree, the class requirements, is not currently eligible to take further classes at the high school level. And yet, if that student is also not ready to take basic freshman classes at the university level, I don't believe they should be paying university tuition. They should be able to get the assistance they need through the high school, so that these families aren't paying, you know, even though our tuition doesn't cover the cost of them being a student there, but they're not paying $12,000 a year or 14 or whatever it is currently, that they should, I think, be able to assume that with a high school diploma, they have basic skills adequate for freshman level work in a general program. So would the, maybe you're not the person to answer this, but would the middle college model allow that?
And through the chair, Representative Gardner, that was my understanding what that middle college level would assist in, is helping with that transition from high school to college.
And to whom would the expense fall, or on whom would the expense fall?
Well, it hasn't been completely fleshed out, but I think the intent is that it would be back on the K-12 system.
Thank you.
Representative Keller.
On that topic, I just want to make sure I understand. I think you said that when you have 21 credits and you've passed both all parts of the, you cannot go back. But they can, right? They can stay in K-12 system and take whatever courses. In other words, just because they have 21 credits, a student does, and has passed the high school qualifying exam, they still can attend school. In fact, there's many seniors in our high schools all across the state that are in that category, am I understanding?
But according to the chair.
Just now, let's
go ahead.
Mr. Jeans, can you address that? We have a question here of what?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. In a student senior year, many students take more than the 21 credits that are required to graduate. But I believe that where Representative Gardner was going is, once you've completed that senior year, passed your high school qualifying exam, you would not be welcome back into the public school system. So if you were in your senior year, had 23 credits, passed the high school qualifying exam, and you were 18, I believe she's correct. You would not be welcome back into the public schools.
Okay, Representative Gardner.
I was just going to say the same thing. It's the first line up there. Mm-hmm. Completed 12th grade and degree requirements. You're
right
out of there.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Eddie, is that going to get fleshed out this year, do you think, as far as what that, I mean, it's embarrassing to me to think that we're graduating kids out of high school that have to have anything remedial when they go to college. And that's terrible. And I don't think that should be happening. If we've got people that are going to go to college, unless there's people that are going to college and there's just no way they can go. But I do know an instance, even in my own town, where the child could have gone to college, but didn't elect to take the classes. He took the easy classes all the way through high school, and so really wasn't prepared for college. And so when he went to college, he hated it. He couldn't get it. He came back home and did something else. And is there any way for us to deal with that, or is that individual, is it the family's fault? Is it, you know, some instances, if the parents don't insist that they take the right classes, we can't blame the school. So where are we at with that?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the department has not completely flushed that concept out, nor do I believe that we will be in a position to do it this year. But clearly it is a concern of the Commissioner of Education, and it is something that we need to work on. And obviously this committee and the Senate committee are the ones that will need to be looking at that as well. But I'm not sure that this is going to be the year to talk about adding middle colleges to public schools.
Well, thank you, Eddie. And I do want to make sure that, you know, we are trying to talk about the funding formula today. I mean, this is really important, important issues, because we're talking about it as if the only purpose for high school is to get somebody into college, when about 70% of our students in the state of Alaska do not go to college. So we have to, this is one of our big problems that we're addressing, whether it's going to be vocational education or something else. We need standards that are appropriate for the students in Alaska to give them full options. But I want to just bring us back to the majority of the students in the state of Alaska do not go to college. And we have, I think, the most number of units are actually given by the regional campuses, not by the three main campuses. And so there are opportunities at less than full tuition, full room and board cost to go to the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Anchorage, or Southeast to take, if you want to go to college and you are in a remedial situation, to get some of those courses. So I think that we're, you know, it's an important topic, and we will have the regional campuses here before us. We will have the university main campuses here before us for overviews. And I think that these are very vital things to ask them, but I want to bring us back from the general philosophy here to the formula for today. Representative Gardner, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't take much time, but I just want to say that while it's true that not every student is going to go to college, or indeed should go to college, we know that nationally our college attendance is sliding, and it impacts this entire country. And we know that the number of Alaskans who go to college relative to other states is low. And of those who do go, the number who complete a program, whether it's a four-year degree or anything else, is not acceptable. I mean, it's not a service to us. We don't have the people and the expertise and the skills we need in a host of fields. So any long-term education plan, I think, needs to work toward encouraging and making it possible for more people to be ready to go, and to finish.
And I think we all agree with that. Eddie?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Children who are 5 years of age before September 1st, following the beginning of the school year, may enter kindergarten. Kindergarten is not required in the state of Alaska, but all of our schools are offering full-time kindergarten programs. Then,
Eddie, before you go on, about what proportion of the children that are eligible for kindergarten actually attend kindergarten? The districts all offer it, but I'm just trying to figure out what proportion of the students across the state actually avail themselves of that program.
Mr. Chairman, I couldn't answer that, but I can tell you that the number of students in kindergarten is pretty close to the same number of students that are in first grade. And So that I think most people that want to take advantage of it are taking advantage of it. Obviously, some families elect to homeschool their children, so those children would not necessarily be in the public school system, but they could be in one of our correspondence programs. That's just a hard one to answer.
Yeah, okay, so it's pretty universally, even though it's voluntary, it's pretty universally used.
It is okay. Universally used. Mr. Chairman, a child with a disability and has an active IEP, individual education program, may enter school at the age of 3. In fact, schools are required to do child finds to help identify children with disabilities that need services. And they can remain in public schools up until the age under 22, so through 21. We have 5 steps that we go through to calculate a district's entitlement for adjusted average daily membership. The first step is to adjust the ADM, or student population, for school size. And we have a table for that, and we'll get to it in just a minute. The next is to determine if the district as a whole is eligible for the hold harmless. The next step, we apply the area cost differential, or district cost factors. Next, we increase that product by 20% for special needs. Then the next step is we calculate the intensive services funding for the intensive needs children. And next, we adjust it for the correspondence students. And once we've gone through all these steps, and we're going to go through it with Nome as our example, we're going to walk through all these steps, we end up with what we call the district's adjusted average daily membership.
And Eddie, under correspondence students, now charter schools are fully counted, and flex school or whatever, those alternative schools, are they all counted? They're not counted as correspondence. Correspondence is just non-physical attendance, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, correspondence is defined in our regulations. I believe it's less than 3 hours a week of face-to-face interaction with a certified teacher. So charter schools may be a correspondent, and we do have some charter schools that are correspondents or homeschool support programs. And homeschool support programs are also classified as as correspondents in our state.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, the first thing we have to do in step one is determine the student population within the community. And Alaska statutes tell us that if there's 10 to 100 students in that community, we're going to run that student population through the size adjustment table once. If the student population is 101 to 425 within that community, we'll run it through the table twice. We'll split it out K6, 712. And if the student population within a community is greater than 425, each one of the school facilities that they have in that community goes through the table independently. Mr. Chairman, the alternative schools, as you previously mentioned, they have to have 200 students. Typically, these are in your larger communities. They're alternative high schools or specialized programs where students have to apply to attend. So it's not your typical community. You know, you live in this neighborhood, so you go to that school. So in under the law, you have to have more than 200 students in those alternative programs to count as a separate site. For charter schools, you have to have more than 150 students. So, Mr. Chairman, we're going to use Nome as the example, as I mentioned earlier. You can see here that Nome, in their elementary school, they have...
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Representative Boop, didn't see you down there.
I was trying to get your attention. I'm sorry. Eddie, as we go through these things, this is a system that you guys have created, this step one.
Correct.
We would also, I guess, as a summary, I hope that we're going to be getting that. If you have suggestions where this works or could it be improved on, as you know, the model that you've been using, I mean, this is what you do and this is how you do it. If you feel that, you know, somebody in your agency or your department says this is okay, but you know, we need to revamp that and look at it differently, we're hoping that you're also going to include that, those suggestions, in this process.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Munoz, and then I.
Thank you. Eddie, could you help me understand why charter schools are below, I'm sorry, charter schools below 150 are funded at a lesser rate than charter schools over 150?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Munoz, that was a policy call on the legislature's part, that if you have, our charter school legislation allows up to 60 charter schools in the state of Alaska. If you don't set some kind of minimum level that you would expect, then in places like Juneau, Anchorage, Fairbanks, you could see a whole bunch of charter schools pop up that are serving 50, 60, 70 children. That's not very efficient in terms of economies of scale. And so the cost to operate those programs are extremely high. So basically, the legislature said, we want a minimum size. The size right now in law is 150. It was 200 when the law was first passed. We included charter schools in the alternative category. But from our position, the administration's position, it's an issue about economies of scale. And if you allow too many really small charter schools, the cost to for the public education goes way up. And so we want to encourage larger programs.
And Eddie, so the difference between the alternative schools and the charter school size, is that just a policy call, or is there a reason
that,
why
200? Mr. Chairman, that is a policy call by the legislature.
And Eddie, how many charter schools do we have in the state, you know? I'll be getting to that later.
I think we have about 22 charter schools.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Well, Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Just as a follow-up, the school here in Juneau, the charter school, correct, I believe has about 65 students.
Correct.
And they, out of that budget that they get, they pay for their facility as well, which generally is a cost borne on the taxpayers and the state, the facility costs, that is. And out of that budget, they're receiving approximately 80% of the average per student allocation for this kids in this district, yet they have additional costs associated with that particular program. So I just point that out as a funding issue. And
I'm well aware of it. and actually, there is a bill on the Senate side, Senate Bill 58, I think it is, that will be taking a look at the size adjustment for charter schools under 150 students. I do want to say that the department recognizes the substantial decrease in funding level for charter schools below 150. There's a number of ways that we can look at smoothing that out, and I'm sure we'll be having that discussion in this committee as well. And there again, it will be a policy call on your part where you draw that line.
Any other questions?
Okay.
Go ahead, Eddie.
Okay, thank you. As I mentioned, we're going to use Nome as our example. The elementary school in Nome has 355 students. The high school has 255. Nome does have a charter school that has fewer than 150 students. That's the Anvil City Science Academy. They have 44 students. And then Nome does have a youth detention facility there that currently serves 14 students. So because the charter school is under 150, the law tells us add it to the school with the largest student population. In this case, it's the elementary school. I'll tell you, here in Juneau, it's the high school, obviously, that they get added in with. And so for the elementary count, we're going to add the 44 to the 355, and we have 399. Here's the school size adjustment table, and this is actually set in law. And if we go down the lines real quickly, you'll see here where it says school size, what we're talking about is student population within a school. So this says if you have 10 to 20 students, we're going to fund you at a weighted average daily membership of 39.6. And then if you have 20 to 30 students, we're going to fund you at 39.6 plus 1.62 for every child over 20. So when you get to exactly 30 students, this formula here on this line will produce 55.8, which gets carried down to the next line.
Go ahead. Eddie, would you explain under the formula the numbers over there? What are those numbers mean? The 39.6. What is that? Just a, is that some kind of ratio? Is that a,
when the funding formula was developed back in 1998 by a study group, McDowell Group here in town, what they said was, if you have a, since we're going to fund based on students in our formula, you can't just say you have 10 kids times X dollars, that's how much money you're going to get to operate that school. There's an economy of scale that occurs as your school gets larger. It's cheaper to operate. It's less expensive to operate. So they came up with this sliding scale and said, look, if you have 10 to 20 students, you have to have a base level of funding. And they calculated that out to be 39.6 adjusted student population. Okay. As we move down the formula, this part here, right here, is your sliding scale. So it goes, the weighting goes to 1.62 for 20 to 30 students, goes to 1.49 for 30 to 75 students. And you can see as the population gets larger, your adjustment's going to get smaller. But your base funding here is carried through. Yep.
Representative Booth.
Based on per student. That's the part of that you omitted there, is that this is all per student, and that's the ratio that it's based on. So this is the oversight that we're using here, is that different areas, different numbers of students, and the cost per student is based on that, and those are the numbers that are corresponding to that.
Through the chair, Representative Book, this doesn't even get into the region that you're in.
I understand, but
this is simply an economies of scale adjustment.
Right, per student.
On a per student basis.
Right.
So once again, if you have between 10 and 19, then that's calculated as if you had a school that had 39.6 kids in it.
Correct.
If you had a school of exactly 750, you would be calculating that school as if it had 793.6 students in it. And if it had more than that, you would take 0.84 times that number of students above, and then times the total population, then subtract 750, which is basically the number of students above.
Correct, Mr. Chairman. So if you have over 750 students in that school, you would receive 0.84 for each additional child, and that would be added to the 793.6 to arrive at your adjusted average daily membership for that school. So, Mr. Chairman, if we've got Nome right here for their elementary school, 399 students. This falls down on our on line six of right under 400. So you take the 399 students, subtract 250, you'll have 149 remaining. You multiply the 149 times the 0.97, and that will give you 144.53. The 144.53 is then added to the 326.10, and you will arrive at the product of 470.63. On the secondary, they had 225 students. In this case, we use the same line in the funding formula, the 250 to 400. And so you subtract the 255 from 250, will give you five students at 0.97, will give you 4.85. You add that to the 326.10, and you will arrive at the product of 330.95.
Okay, so Eddie, so we're breaking apart the K through 6 and the 7 through 12 as far as calculation of the school or the facilities, but they're calculated separately, but they're at exactly the same rate, same scale is used.
Mr. Chairman, in this particular case, it just so works out that they're in the same scale on the table. I'll have to tell you that's unusual.
No. Yeah, I didn't even mean that they were all in number 6 there. I meant that this is the same table for both elementary and for secondary, but you just make two calculations.
Mr. Chairman,
one
you're
for
correct.
Secondary and one for elementary in the school district.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, in Nome, they have over 425 students total, and so the law tells us to fund each one of their schools independently. They have a high school, middle school, and an elementary school. So we run each of those calculations through the table.
And if they had less than the 425?
It would still be the same because down to 100, you fund for two schools.
Okay.
The difference would be is if they had a separate middle school, we would be doing this calculation three times because they have over 425 students.
Okay.
But they don't have a middle school out there. It's part of the high school.
Are there any questions before we go on this calculation? Okay, go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, the last calculation is a detention facility out there. They have 14 students in that program, so they're funded at the base allocation at 39.60. We total the 470 plus the 330 plus the 39 will get you up to 841 school size adjusted average daily membership.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
Thank you. I just want to make a comment about the 425 students. If you have 425 students, you get to count every single building you have, right?
Correct.
And if you are under that, you don't get to count, you only get to count two schools, right?
Correct.
Okay, so how many are there now that are under that? So if they have more schools that they've got kids in, but we're only paying them for two schools?
I'll have to find that out for you.
Okay.
Because you're thinking of Wrangell?
I'm thinking of Wrangell, but I know that there were some other ones too.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
And Eddie, is this done like on the rural attendance areas? Well, I mean, is this done by the district or?
These calculations here? The districts can do them, but I mean, we do them at the department.
No, but you do them by district, so. Or are they done? They're done. Here we have Nome City Schools.
Right. In the regional education attendance areas, we look at each community individually.
Okay.
And we have to make that first determination. Is there 10 to 100 students? If there are, one school. In that community, are they 100 to 425? Two schools.
Okay,
for example,
the Kenai Peninsula, where you have
Homer, Soldotna,
each one
individually.
By, so the communities are separated, even though it's within a district.
Correct.
Okay. Representative Boot.
That was what I was going to verify. Okay. Is that we're looking at this from a community perspective.
Correct. So, like in Kenai, Soldotna, Homer, Seward, they're all counted individually.
Nanwalek, Port Graham.
Exactly.
Each one.
You got it.
Okay. Thank you. Is there any other questions on that portion? Okay.
Okay. The next step that we have to do is determine whether or not the district is entitled to the Hold Harmless that was passed last year. And basically what this says is if they have a decrease of 5% or more in this previous calculation that we just did, the adjusted ADM for school size, not actual student population, but the adjusted ADM for school size, then we're going to provide them with some Hold Harmless funding for a three-year period. And what we provide them with is 75% of the difference from last year to this year, the first year, 50% of the second year and the base year, and then 25% And it just so happens that based on the projected student data that Nome would qualify for the Hold Harmless in fiscal year 09, based on their projections, we estimated their school size adjustment to be 965. We just went through the calculation and calculated it for fiscal year 10 at 841. The difference is 123. That's a 12.84% drop. So they qualify for the Hold Harmless. The important piece here then is that 010 here becomes the base year. And so for the two subsequent years, we're going to look back to 010. We're not going to have to go through this calculation here, the percentage, but in calculating how much Hold Harmless they're going to receive, we're always going to look back to that base year. So in this case, 75% of the difference of 123 is 92. That gets added to our base year of 010, and the adjusted ADM for school size is 934.11. Yes.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Because there's been a lot of movement from the rural areas to cities, are we seeing more changes in those areas? I mean, when I first came in, I think there were three schools that were in the category that we were just talking about for not that were under the 425. And are we seeing more schools lose so many that now that we've got more schools in that category? In other words, you know, are we seeing more schools also in this category as far as that they've lost over 5% and so now they're in the area of Hold Harmless?
Well, through the chair, Representative Wilson, this is the first year that the Hold Harmless has been in place. So I can't really speak to who would have qualified or who has qualified for the Hold Harmless, seeing as how it's the first year. We had a similar Hold Harmless provision in the old funding formula back in 1988 through 98. But when the new funding formula was developed, that Hold Harmless provision was dropped. And part of that had to do with the transition funding that was provided under the new formula, the supplemental funding floor. You right. Remember that?
Right.
That's
okay.
Almost gone now.
Okay, that's what I was thinking,
yeah.
Of, I think. Okay.
So,
Eddie, a question here. So this is a can you back up one slide?
Yep.
So this difference is made for the 010 year, and then that becomes the base year that we then apply the deductions to. So what happens if the school size goes up above that base?
Then they would be on their new funding level. And they would have more than they have under this scenario.
Okay, so if their actual calculated daily membership is below 934, then this base year would still apply, and the next year would be 50% of it, and 25%. But if they got 940 students, then
they're funded at 940 students.
Funded at 940.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. And Representative Wilson.
Okay. I just want to thank you very much. Sorry. I just want to clarify it in my mind. I thought that they, again, had to drop 5% the next year. They don't?
No. The 5% drop is that's the trigger in the first year.
Okay.
And it also establishes the base year that we go back and measure against.
Representative Keller.
Two questions, please. One is just a follow-up on that one. So if we had another 5% lost, you'd have another trigger, and it would start again in a three-year process.
And through the chair, Representative Keller, under the old funding formula, I had that happen a couple times. And basically what we do at that point is we calculate it both ways, figure out what is in the best interest of the district, and we go with what benefits them.
Representative Keller.
And the second question is also a follow-up for Representative Wilson's. How many districts qualify for the Hold Harmless position in your calculations that you're doing now, and what is the dollar figure that we're talking about. And I know we can figure it out here for Nome easily, but I'm talking about statewide.
And through the chair, Representative Keller, I'll have to get back to you on that. In this particular case, we're using projected ADMs, and as an example, in doing the actual calculations, we use actual ADM from the prior year and actual ADM in the current year. So I'm going to have to get that information. I'll get it back to you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Eddie, earlier you mentioned that schools that fall below 10, rural schools, that they are not eligible then for the site funding, $200,000. Does this provision also apply to the site funding, the 75% and so on?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, no. The hold harmless applies to the district as a whole. But in those districts that have really small sites, typically they have very small student populations. And so when one site falls below that 10, that loss of that 39 adjusted ADM typically is enough to trigger the hold harmless for the district as a whole. Okay. But I can't say that it always happens, because there will be one instance when it doesn't.
Thanks, Eddie. Go ahead.
All right. Okay. District cost factors. There is a provision in the law that says that the department's supposed to monitor the cost factors and make recommendations to the legislature every other year. The legislature just adopted the cost factors recommended by ICER last year, phased it in over a five-year period. So we'll see slight increments over the next 4 years in our budget for the cost differential. Also, the legislature passed a resolution last year establishing the task force for geographic cost differentials that will start meeting this year. So any changes to the cost differentials will be coming from, or recommended changes will be coming from that committee, not from the department. Although we will be there to support the committee. The lowest cost factor is a 1.0. The highest is 1.948. I believe that's Aleutian Region. The next step in the formula is we take the previous adjusted ADM, the 934.11, and we multiply that times the geographic or district cost factor to come up with a new product of 1,309.62. The cost factors are to adjust for regional cost differences. So how much more does it cost for fuel? What's that ratio? Getting the same qualified teachers in those regions, that was another consideration under ICER. Shipping costs would be another consideration. So the next step is the special needs funding. This is for our categorical programs for special education, except for the intensive needs students. Vocational education, gifted, talented, bilingual, bicultural are all block funded at 20%. And all the districts have plans on file with the department. The calculation is we take the previous product of 1,309, multiply it times 1.20. Our new product is 1,571.54. You see down here at the bottom our little note shown on column R, page 8. That's back to the funding program overview that I mentioned earlier on the spreadsheet. You can refer back to the spreadsheet and see where that calculation is. Next, we have the intensive needs funding adjustment.
Eddie.
Yes, sir.
Let's back up for just a minute. Just to raise a flag to everybody, because I presume that we'll be talking about this. The categorical programs funded at, block funded at 20%. Having vocational education and special education together, bilingual, are there some of those that are federally mandated so that we have a problem of competing funds, since that's a single block grant?
Mr. Chairman, are you referring to our maintenance of effort calculations with federal programs, or I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Vocational education is something that's been a critical issue around him. And, of course, it was not in this committee, just formed, but in the Education Funding Task Force that met summer before we passed the new law. We had quite a bit of testimony that vocational education just doesn't get any money because it's in the block grant with special education, and the mandates that are required to fund special education basically, and some of the other things possibly, just require that all the money go not to vocational education but to those. So I'm trying to figure out, because I think everybody on the committee has been saying we need to look at how do we increase vocational education, and I'm wanting to find out if you in the department feel that that testimony was accurate and that that is one of the causes of the decline of vocational education, or is there some, I'm sure there's other reasons as well, but is that one of the funding reasons?
Mr. Chairman, under the previous funding formula, we did have categorical funding for bilingual, bicultural, the special education, and vocational education. And I'll tell you that for directors of those programs in the school districts, that was pretty nice because you could look right at the funding formula and say, hey, our program generates X amount of dollars. School board, that's what you should be spending on it. When we went to the block funding, that made their jobs a little more difficult because you can't put your finger on my piece of the pie. Increased costs in special education, absolutely. So that is a drain. But I think what's really drawn money out of vocational education has more to do with the focus on meeting the standards in reading, writing, and math, and the requirements under NCLB. So we've really focused in on those three basic skills. And so, that's what districts are measured against in terms of whether or not they're performing. And so I think vocational education has seen a slide because of that.
Okay, Representative Keller, did you have?
This is Jermaine. Thank you. The sequence of the calculations with ADM, number five is adding the correspondence program. So that implies to me that as a matter of policy, we have said that the correspondence programs do not deal with special ed, vocational, gifted, and bilingual. And I think that's a nuance that I would like us to, keep in mind and consider as it goes on. And I was wondering if Eddie had some comments on that.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, the correspondence calculation, where it ended up, I don't think was really a policy call other than that's just where it fell out in the formula when we were discussing the new funding formula. That what the real policy call was at the time was correspondence students were counted and funded like a school under the previous funding formula. And the legislature said, look, you don't have all the costs associated with a building in insurance, maintenance, and all that. So the funding for correspondence was a policy decision was made to simply fund them at 80% of the student count because they don't have the overhead that's associated with other public schools. And I think that was just
a follow-up. And Representative Keller, could you clarify your question for me again? I kind of missed.
It took me a while to grasp it too, so I understand. But when the department is calculating, this is a little bit of background, calculating the amount of money that goes to the district, they add the 20% to the adjusted ADM before they take into account the correspondence programs. And the significance of that is the district does not get any extra money, for having a correspondence program that you know, has to deal at some level with this 20% category, the special ed and whatever. So, and then there's an additional 80%, you know, that is also a factor. And that was all a struggle in figuring out what's appropriate, you know, and that's just where we are. But the what the effect is, as I understand it, is that the correspondence programs are in a position that may be good, may be bad, but they deal with the district of residence of the correspondence program student that is special ed. So if they get an enrollee from a district, then the correspondence program district has to make some kind of an arrangement with the district of residence to deal with the special needs situation. And it's working, but it's just, like I say, a nuance that we need to look at probably at some point.
Yeah, I think that that'll be a point that we'll need to look at in a little more detail, sure, other than the funding. Representative Wilson, then Gardner.
Thank you, and that was what I was going to mention. If we're going to go into a separate meeting with correspondence schools, because I have a lot I would like to say about it, but I don't want to take up. So if we are going to do a meeting for that, then I won't even go into it right now if we're going to go into it later.
We will be. We'll have an overview on correspondence, regional high schools, or regional schools, other
schools.
So we're going to review in the policy issues in detail. This is just really the funding formula for today so that we understand that calculation. So we will keep that in mind and bring it up. If you don't feel we're fully covering it, we will make sure that we get it. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I want to go back to the special needs factor a little bit and make sure I understand what you're saying. Is that previously, or there was a time when each of the elements of that category were funded specifically and directly, and it made it easier for the advocates for special ed or vocational education to identify their portion of the money and lobby to have that. And under our current system, the need, that money has been sort of subsumed into the general budget, and the needs or the requirements of No Child Left Behind have meant that there's not as much available, or that it's harder for people to identify funding that at one time they could claim for special ed or vocational education or some other category. And consequently, I mean, if you draw the lines, it's that No Child Left Behind has really adversely impacted to some degree the services we provide under special needs. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, I would not say NCLB has adversely impacted the services that special education children require. With special education, you develop an IEP, and that basically becomes a contract between the parents and the district to provide certain services, and the district is bound by that, regardless of the cost. In the categorical funding that we had previously, the three categories was special education, bilingual, bicultural, and vocational education. What I want to make clear is it wasn't categorical expenditure requirements. In other words, districts were not required to spend their money on that particular area because they generated it there. It was just simply a way to generate revenue for those types of programs. There was a belief at the time that some students were inappropriately being labeled to generate revenue because during the 80s, we had very low oil revenues coming into the state. The student population was relatively flat, but every year when we were coming in with our budget, we were seeing increases in special education and bilingual. But the overall population was relatively flat. So when the funding formula was being discussed, the legislature said, we're not really sure that this is accurate. Maybe we should just go to a block funding mechanism. And that's how we arrived at the 20%. Now, when this funding formula was implemented back in 1998, I went back and looked at how much did the 20% generate for all those kids, and how much would they have generated through the individual categories. And under the 20% allocation, it actually, excuse me, with the 20% and intensive combined, it was actually more than what was being allocated for those three categories under the previous funding formula. Not a whole lot more, and I'll tell you that it varied from district to district. So some districts that had a very large bilingual populations actually received less under this funding formula. Other districts made some up. But it was simply a policy call to, and I think part of it was because we don't have categorical expenditure requirements. And in many states, they do have those categorical expenditure requirements. You generate so much money for this purpose, you need to spend it there. And if you don't, the excess comes back to the state. So that I hope that gives you a little history on how we got where we are.
And follow up, Representative Gardner.
Well, I have a lot of constituents with special ed students, and the attorney who sues the school district regularly is a constituent also. And they feel that special ed students in particular are not getting their share of the funding, or certainly that they're not getting effective services. So it's one of the things just for this committee that, you know, I don't know if they're accurate, or maybe the vast majority of people are happy with the services their kids get, and it's the squeaky wheel that's kind of creating that impression. It's really hard to measure and evaluate that. But I was struck by your description of the change in how it's done, so it's harder for people to know.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Eddie. Here in Juneau, we have a new program called the ACE Academy down at the high school, and at that academy, you can take drafting and architectural courses, CAD, construction, et cetera. Would that program be eligible for the additional 20%, or are they just counted on a pure ADM figure? Just using that as an example.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Munoz, that we don't look at individual programs. As it will become very clear to you in just a minute, these are all additive adjustments. So the 20% is an adjustment after we've done the school size adjustment, after we've applied the geographic differential, then we bump that product up by 20%. So every student in the district is generating some, you know, a portion of this 20%. Yet not every student is receiving special education, bilingual, or vocational services. But it's simply a mechanism to allocate resources.
Right.
Does that answer your question?
Not really.
So to clarify, Eddie, is it correct then that what we're doing is we're just saying we're going to consider as if the population of the school was 20% larger under these calculations, and then and we're doing that for the reason so that you'll have money for these programs.
To assist with these programs, and you figure out what you need to do to provide them.
Right. So even if there's not any special need or special education, gifted and talented vocational education program in a school, that school, every school is going to have 20% allocated to allow those programs to go forward, and doesn't.
Well, I don't want to say that every school is going to be allocated 20%, because that's up to the local school board and how they allocate their resources with their budget. This is simply a mechanism to provide additional state resources to assist with those three areas, and it's up to the local school board to figure out how to deliver the services.
Sure. Okay. Representative Munoz.
So all schools then get this extra funding and they determine how to allocate it, or do they have to determine the number of special needs students in each of these different categories to get the money? I guess I'm unclear on that.
The district as a whole receives the 20% adjustment. So it doesn't go to individual schools.
No, I mean that. I meant the district.
Yeah, the district as a whole.
But they must demonstrate that they have students in those programs, correct?
Or no.
No.
Okay. That's why it's called block funding. It's a way to allocate state resources, and it's up to the local school boards to determine how and what level of gifted, talented programs they're going to offer, bilingual programs. Like I said, with special ed, it's pretty. It's a contract. You know, you go in and meet with the teachers and the psychologists, and you're signing a contract, and they have to provide the services in that IEP.
Did you have a follow-up? Okay, Representative Booth.
The takeaway from this, to me, is that some of us haven't realized that, you know, we want to provide for those particular students that create a huge component of the cost because that's the right thing to do. However, we also have to understand when we do that, we encumber the whole community. And that, in fact, has been what's been happening to the degree in some communities at the expense of everybody in that community, whether they knew it and agreed to it or not. So that's a huge component of my trying to understand and get a grip on where we're going to go and why we've gotten to where we're at.
Okay. And I do want to get back. We don't want to run out of time for
right.
the calculations of how we get okay. the funding right. formula here. Right. So unless anybody has any other questions on the math here, I'm going to
okay.
Eddie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I mentioned, the next adjustment is the funding for intensive needs students. These students are counted on the last day of the count period. You need to be aware that they are also counted in the regular ADM. So a student that requires intensive needs services, these are basically your multi-handicapped children, require full-time, all-day assistance, and can be medically fragile or typically are medically fragile children. The funding in 09 is $49,000 additional funding for these children. In 010 it will go to $61,000, and then in FY 011 I believe it gets up to right at $75,000 per child. Right now we are right below 2,000 children statewide in this particular category.
Eddie, there was some talk of movement of students after the enrollment period. Is there anything that tracks these students if they move from one district to another? Is it does the district that has them enrolled on the 20th day have the funding for the year and the other district?
Mr. Chairman, I looked at that a couple years back, and after the count period, I had 27 intensive needs students statewide that moved. The largest impact was a plus three students in Ketchikan, I believe it was, after the count period. So I hear about it too. I don't know that it's as big a problem as people make it out to be, because you have children moving in and out. But typically this population doesn't move a whole lot because the families are trying to get those service, continuous services for those children. And we will be looking at this year and the last 2 years to make sure that that is a, you know, pretty standard, and I'll get that back to you.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may mention, you know, this increased funding with the intensive needs students that's coming through the formula is going to free up money that was previously used for this category of students. So when you look at the 20% block funding plus the intensive needs, these are substantial increases that districts are going to be receiving this year, next year, and the following year. And going into the 010 budget, this particular category by itself, I believe, is $22 million, the adjustment from 09 to 010 on a statewide basis. So,
Reverend Munoz.
Thank you. Do you have a system of following up with the districts, an accountability system to determine that there's a certain criteria that these students are being, that they're meeting to get this additional funding?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, Representative Munoz, actually we do. We look at every new intensive needs claim every year. Although I'll tell you, this year I'm requesting in our budget an increase of $150,000 because I would like to contract with some retired special ed people to do 100% review on an annual basis. When we get up to $75,000 per child, they better be meeting the criteria and we do have it laid out in regulation.
Representative Wilson.
This is just a question, Eddie. When an intensive needs student goes from one school to another school or from one district, I guess from one school district to another school district, do they carry that IEP with them or do they start over then at the new school with a new IEP?
They do carry the IEP with them, but the IEPs are reviewed on an annual basis. And I can't tell you specifically, but I'll find out if when a new student comes in, if there's a review immediately or not.
A follow-up, Representative Wilson.
A follow-up is, I can see where maybe in the Anchorage schools, because they're in a big town and there's a lot of services, that they might be able to service certain things in the IEP and be able to provide them. But if they move to a smaller school, to a smaller district, or out in another area, and they might, I mean, they might not even be available there, do they still have to then meet that? And that's a big expense then for the school if they have to fly somebody in to do that. Is that?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's exactly what happens. And those districts that cannot provide or do not have the services locally available utilize the services from CESA, the Special Education Service Agency, which is also funded by the state. But typically, you do not see the migration in that direction. You see it the other direction where the services are.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks, Eddie.
Okay, so in this case, Nome had 5 intensive needs students at 11 times. Obviously, that's 55, so we add that to the 1,571, and we're up to 1,626. As we touched on with correspondence, they're funded at 80% of the ADM, and so each student in 2010 will generate approximately $4,464. In this case, Nome had 8.5 students, or projects 8.5 students, at 80% of 6.08. We add that to the previous product of 1,626, and we're up to 1,633. The 1,633 adjusted average daily membership for the district of Nome is then multiplied times the base student allocation, which in 2010 will be 5,580, which will provide a basic need of $9,114,000.
Representative Wilson.
Oh, okay, thank you very much. So Eddie, when we're doing the correspondence programs, when we did the all the other steps before that, they were counted fully. All the other steps before that. So now they're counting them at 80%. So actually they did get some credit along the line to begin with, didn't they?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the correspondents do not get credit for geographic differential, special needs. They are added at the end of the equation at 80%.
Oh.
And that's what Representative Keller was bringing to the attention of the committee.
And Eddie, can you provide us in some future time some identification of how many of the correspondent students are special education, or how many are, would fit into those?
I believe I can.
Yeah,
I believe I can. I'll look at our data. I mean, we have student data, individual student data for every child enrolled in public schools.
Sure. So, well, I guess what I'm trying to figure out is the 20% or the school size. I mean, if you're not providing facilities for those things, if we would put it in earlier in the formula and calculate it in the school size when that's not part of the school size of the district because it's handled through correspondence. I mean, you're not providing a chair and a facility and heating
right.
a room, and I think that's probably why that is calculated at the end. But I'm, since members of the committee are concerned that there's requirements in correspondence that aren't being calculated in the formula by anything at the end. I'd just like to get some handle on whether that's, you know, we can have that idea, whether that idea is correct or not.
Yeah, we can look at that data for you.
Thanks.
Yeah. In fact, Mr. Chairman, in many cases, the district that the child resides in claims the child as a quarter FTE to provide special education services, and then the correspondence district claims them for 0.75. But that does take some coordination between the two districts, and sometimes there's a lot of friction in that arrangement.
Okay, Representative Boop.
Your acronyms, I'm not quite as familiar with your acronyms as some FTE.
Full-time equivalent.
Right, okay. Just trying to keep up to speed with vernacular here. Thank you.
Sure. Okay, this is the schedule that I thought would help Representative Munoz. As we start with our adjustment up at the top, school size, as it's been adjusted for hold harmless, is 934.11. Next step, we multiply that times the cost factor. We take that product, increase it by 20%. I believe this is where Representative Keller may suggest that the correspondence should go before the 20% adjustment. Then we add to that the adjustment for the intensive needs students at 55, and then the correspondence students is added to that product to come up with the 1,633 times the base student allocation, which will be 5,580, and we come up with our basic need of 9,114,000.
Representative Keller.
Would you indulge me a comment?
Sure.
Thank you. It was always confusing to me when I was getting a grasp on this, just exactly what base student allocation means. And, you know, in what Eddie has very, you know, eloquently done, you know, is explained that. But it's the tendency, I think, in the press to go out when we say we $5,580 figure. And in reality, for Nome, for example, in this case, we're talking $13,392 per student, you know. And so often that the message gets out, you know, and everybody thinks, well, $5,500, you know, that's nothing. But per student revenue is a very important part of this factor. And I believe there is a question here, and is it not true that EED has posted on the website per student revenue in all the different categories, not just the state, but all of it.
Through the chair, that's correct. Thank Representative what, Keller? Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so now that we've determined basic need, this is what I call the entitlement. The entitlement is the $9 million through our public school funding formula. The next question we ask, as I posed to you yesterday, who pays for that? And we have our three components: the required local contribution, federal impact aid, and whatever's left over is your state aid through the funding formula. And we talked a little bit about the local effort. This was passed, there was an amendment to the required local effort back in 2001, where we can't count half the increased property value from 1999. We're not gonna rehash this, we had a good discussion about it the other day. So here's the Nome's calculations. Their required local effort will be based on a value of $238 million. At four mills, will generate $955,000. The foundation funding formula has a test here. It says if your required local effort is the lesser of four mills or 45% of basic need from the preceding year. This way, every organized area is required to contribute something to support education. In North Slope, Valdez, and Skagway, their property value is quite high on a per student basis. So not on a per student basis, but just property value. The four mills would far exceed 45% of basic needs. So in those three communities, their required local contribution is 45% of basic need, and not the four mills. Federal impact aid. We touched on this a little bit the other day. Your federal impact aid is in lieu of local property taxes. It's for areas that are non-taxable due to federal action. So our military bases, where people live on the military bases in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Kodiak, people that reside on ANCSA lands that are non-taxable under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, people that reside in our national forests are non-taxable. So all those students, they generate money that goes to the school district.
Wait, just back up, Eddie. So just again, though, those payments are for students or for people that are living on that federal land. So if you have a lot of federal land that takes up tax base out of your district, that doesn't do it unless somebody's living on. So a national park, if there's nobody living in the national park,
it doesn't generate any money.
It doesn't generate any. Okay.
Not through this program.
I just wanted to make it clear.
But it may through forest receipts.
Thank you.
In this case, NOAM has generated $81,000 that's eligible for consideration in our public school funding formula. We talked about this a little bit the other day, the percentage that we kept looking at, that percentage mm-hmm. column, and what does all that mean? Under the federal law, it requires us to calculate that ratio. And so what the simple formula is, we take the required local effort divided by their local revenues in the operating fund. In this case, NOAM's required local effort was the $955,000, which we just calculated a couple slides back. Their budgeted local revenue to support education is $1.9 million. That ratio is 50.14%. So we start with the amount of money that's eligible, the $81,900. We apply the ratio of 50.14. That's for our local contribution. And then the state law says we're going to deduct 90%. Under the federal law, at this point, we could have deducted 100%. We could deduct 5%. It was completely up to the legislature what level they set that at. And the reason the legislature set it at 90% is obviously to give districts some of the revenue that they're applying for to encourage them to apply, because we can't make them apply for these funds. But when you look at the schedule that I distributed, the foundation overview, you'll see that some districts generate substantial amounts of money through this program, because the majority of their students reside on native lands, impact aid, federal
lands. And Eddie, do all districts that are eligible, do they apply?
I'm going to say no, because I know that there are a couple districts that would generate a couple thousand dollars, and it's not worth the effort to the process of verifying the lands and all that is not worth the dollars that they generate.
But there's no place where we have a significant
no. The districts that generate significant amounts, I would say anything over 50,000, they're all applying.
Okay, great. Representative Gardner and then Boop.
That was my question.
Representative Boop.
Last year, Representative Edgman found some federal money that wasn't applied for that he reapplied for, I believe, to the tune of about $25,000. Was that this money? Are you aware of that?
No,
or was
I'm
that
not.
Something totally different?
I don't remember.
Okay. Because he went looking through some records, found it, and said, hey, if we apply, then we get this money and whatever.
Yeah. I'd have to ask him.
If it was different, we can talk about that later. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
We'll check with Representative Edgman.
Right. Okay. Get that. So, we're
actually, before we left the federal aid.
Oh, yes. Representative Boop.
I'm just trying to wrap my arms around this. You know, we had all of these requirements from the federal government, and then we have what we actually get out of the federal government for to meet these requirements. So, out of a $9 million budget, we get $37,000. Is that correct?
I'm not
as
sure.
As a contribution from the federal government for the NOAM area?
Correct.
That's okay. Just trying to
correct.
Just trying to wrap my arms around the numbers.
But through the Impact Aid program, the state is recognizing $56 million, $59 million on a statewide basis through our public school funding formula. So it's pretty substantial.
Representative Booth.
$59 million out of how many billion dollar cost?
The funding formula is about $1 billion.
Thank you.
Yep. So in this case, NOAM's funding formula, basic need is $914,000. Required local effort is $955,000. Impact aid, $36,000, which means the state aid to support NOAM public schools will be $8,121,000. There is additional funds above basic need. Those are the additional local contributions. The reason we have a cap on the local contribution is because to count the federal impact aid dollars, we have to have an equalized funding formula. And the federal law says you can have no more than 25% disparity in your richest and poorest districts in the state. So what causes disparity is the additional revenue that we allow municipal governments to contribute to schools above the 4 mil requirement. So what we've done in our funding formula is we've said, look, you can contribute up to 23% of basic need on top of your required local contribution. And that way we always meet our equity tests with the federal government. So in this case, NOAM's 23% of basic need is $2,096,000. So we add that to their required local effort of $955,000. The maximum local contribution that NOAM can receive from the city is $3,051,000. Now, if they go over that, we either reduce their state aid by the amount that they went over, or they return the money to the city, the excess. And it has happened a couple times, and it's amazing. The schools always return it back to the cities. Okay, we also have a component in the funding formula called quality school grants. And this funding is simply $16 times the adjusted ADM. When the program was initiated back in 1998, we were asking districts to focus this on intervention programs. So to help students with their reading, writing, math. And we're still doing that. But I have to tell you, this may be one of those programs that you want to look at. It may have run its useful life. It's not a whole lot of money. Districts are doing these interventions anyway because of the way we evaluate them on performance based on assessments, on test scores. So this may be one that you want to look at. Yes?
Just a question, but since we are doing it on the adjusted ADM, then the cost factor is taken into account. District cost factor.
The district cost factor, the 20%.
Everything.
Everything. Intensive needs, correspondence, okay. Everything.
Representative Wilson, Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Eddie, I kind of want to go back a little bit and get my hands wrapped around a little bit when we talked about the amount of money that is the local contribution. And when way early on we talked about at the 4 mils, and because we've had this because of the property tax deal where they mm-hmm. that adjusts it. Can some communities, if they can afford it, because they've got an influx of more people to pay taxes, their local contribution is lower, so the state has to pay more? Does that make a difference at all of the amount that they can turn around then and give? Is there anything in there where if they would have given the full four meals right away, is there a difference there in the amount which they would be paying? Now they can get their the amount per student up easier than before.
Well, through the chair, Representative Wilson, basically that the 50% provision for the required local effort basically says that the state is paying approximately $75 million that should be coming from local sources. That's about as simple as I can make it. So the state aid in our schedule here would be $75 million less had that provision not passed. The required local effort, it doesn't matter how many people are in the community. It's based on the value of the property within the community.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
Follow-up. Okay. Well, what I guess, should we allow communities to pay extra to try to get up to the cap when we're paying the state is paying extra because of that adjustment?
That's a good question, Representative Wilson.
Eddie, can I clarify something as well, and that's on the same point? Is there an effect on the amount that a community can contribute if they have had increased property values? And it would you go through that relationship just quickly with us as far as does it lower the cap of what a community
Mr. Chairman, it does lower the cap because the state's paying a portion of the required local effort. So whatever that portion of the required local effort the state is paying would have been added to the cap.
So
in other words,
23% of that, basically 23% of that 75 million. Or
no, the 23% does not apply to the 75 million. For example, if the amount of money that we're providing to Nome through the 50% provision is $45,000, say, then their local cap would be the maximum local cap would be $45,000 higher had that provision not been in place. So instead of $3,050,000, it would be $3,100,000.
Representative Wilson, then follow up Representative Kelly.
Okay, so what that is saying is that doesn't make any difference. Are you saying that really doesn't make any difference, or are you saying that it does make a difference, and if the state is paying part of their local contribution, then why should we let them to pay extra? Is there a difference there?
What I'm saying is I think within a couple years you're going to have a couple districts that are going to have local tax revenue available to them to contribute to education, but the cap is going to be lower than what they anticipate, and so they're going to come to you and look for some kind of relief. But the reason that it's lower, the cap is lower, is because we're subsidizing their local contribution.
Okay.
So it but we're not there yet, but I think it's coming.
Okay, Representative Gardner and then Keller.
My question is on a different subject. So
it is the same subject. I think subsidy may be an unfortunate choice of words, but I would like, if we could, to respectfully request a some kind of a bar graph that shows the amount of local dollars total per community that is actually paid, so that we can compare community to community to see how much is being paid by that community for, and that should be easy to come by, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
And
per
can
student?
We
Well, no, I was just saying about per community.
Wait a minute, folks.
Yeah. Sorry.
And then would you also put the percentage of where people are on the district caps?
Right.
Okay. And now, Representative Wilson, your question for
I wanted to. I mean, I don't think it's fair if you do it per community unless you do it per student.
Okay, so the request is, what's the total dollars paid by a district, and what is the where they are in the cap, and also if we can relate that to the contribution by the community per student.
We can do that.
So are there any other pieces of this data request? Representative Boo.
Has this been done already through ICER?
Through the chair, I don't think so. But it's information that we provide on an annual basis.
Okay. Because if there's already been a study done and that is available, then, you know, just a matter of him locating that information rather than recreating it, I think is,
well,
you know.
We do it on an annual basis.
Right. Okay.
And Representative Book, you know, we're not trying to throw a new study here. I mean, if there's right. if the information is available, right. the district will provide it from whatever source.
Right.
Okay.
Fine.
Exactly. We got it. Thank you.
Did we have any other questions on this point? On anything else so far? Okay, let's go on.
Not on this point.
Representative Gardner.
I did have a question. I think we got as far as the Quality Schools Grant slide. And I just want to make sure I understand. The Quality School Grant funding is distinct, or is it the same as the grant that was implemented, I believe, last session that started out to be a teacher grant and then became kind of a building award for schools that exceeded expectations?
Through the chair, I believe what you're referring to is the performance incentive program.
Right.
Yes,
okay.
And that program is set to sunset this year. The Quality School Grant is a distinct separate component within the foundation program that was intended for interventions to assist struggling students. Yeah. And so, Mr. Chairman, you can see here that the actual state aid that Nome will receive is the formula funding of $8,121,000 plus their quality school grant of $26,000 for a total state entitlement of $8,147,000. And if for some reason there's not enough money appropriated to fund all the costs in the foundation program, then we simply prorate everybody by the same percentage. And any questions?
Yeah. Eddie, last year, you know, we did a formula rewrite so that we would have funding going through the cost differential to make sure that we had kind of an equality of funding versus costs. And I just wanted to bring it to, because there had been a debate in the past on learning opportunity grants or logs that had been used to fund it just on a per student basis, so that every district across the state, no matter what your costs were, got exactly the same amount per student. And last year, you know, we had just gone through this intense process of trying to make school funding equitable to costs, and we reinstituted logs under another name of energy grant, and we did $100 per student.
But Mr. Chairman, that was distributed on the adjusted ADM.
It did go on.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm very pleased to hear that, because we didn't perceive that at the last. So that did go through on adjusted ADM. So it did have the factors. Okay. I just wanted to make sure that as we go forward with proposals that come before us, if we see something where we are changing our philosophy, we make sure we address it as, okay, we're going to change this process and this philosophy, or fund outside of the philosophy that we've adopted, and not just let something slide. So happy to hear that. Representative Gardner.
One other question, and maybe it's to be answered later, but if the district is bound by an IEP and it's a contract regardless of the cost, do we have any way to know if IEPs are constructed sort of to minimize the impact, that if you were thinking only and absolutely of the needs of the student without regard to cost, would our IEPs be different than they are currently?
And Mr. Chairman, I think we're going to have a section on special ed, and I think that would probably be better addressed by our special ed people.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Just one question quick. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Eddie, are there any other, you know, the quality school grants are per student. Are there, what other things are per student that doesn't include the cost, the district cost factor. Can you have that for us next time? Or is there just a couple?
I don't think we have anything else.
Just this?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Boot.
Mr. Chairman, this is a question for you. Were you part of the education task force last summer? I was pretty overwhelmed with some of the times that were going on at that time, and I know that it was chaired by Representative Hawker, but I wasn't aware of who was on that committee exactly.
Yes, Representative Book, I was a member of the Education Funding Task Force, and it wasn't this last summer.
It was the
summer
before.
We were in special session.
Right. Yeah.
So it was the summer before.
You can tell how much time I've lost.
And, you know, almost all of those recommendations were incorporated in the funding formula change that was adopted by the governor, and it's in law, and that's our change for now, and we've built into those the increments for getting 100% of the cost differential in over the four more years, and also the intensive need built into. So those are built into statute.
Correct.
So unless we look at additional statute changing the funding formula, that formula and with those increases are in place.
Thank you.
Representative Munoz? Okay. I don't see any other questions on this then. Just so everybody knows, on Friday we will have the Department of Labor and their programs on workforce development and AvTech, University of Alaska Workforce Development, and we'll have the Department of Education Workforce Development Programs. I think you've been contacted on that, right? Yeah, okay, I see heads nodding from your
I hope so.
Other folks in your department.
You're the
So if there's nothing else, then we will be adjourned at 10:56. Thank you.